Please let me know if my voice drops and you can't hear me at the back. Just sort of scratch your head or something. the way, if everyone's agreeable to this, I'd like to spend the time we have together by following pretty much the same schedule as yesterday, with me giving a talk for an unspecified length of time, and then after that, to give you a chance to comment upon, discuss, ask for clarification of anything that I've been talking about. And then after that, I think we could have a break for a few minutes, and then before we end the meeting, to have a short meditation together. I've received instructions from my mother today that I shouldn't repeat myself and say the same thing that I said yesterday. Because she's made a special effort to come this evening, come all the way from England. This is perhaps a minor point, but something just to, as a way of starting off, the reason why Kumitip just lifted that tray up into my hands. Some of you may be familiar with this custom or training rule that Buddhist monks have, which requires them to have any edibles offered specifically into their hands. Now, if anybody with the kindest intention in the world was just to leave that there, I couldn't touch it. And if it was food, I'd just have to watch it and go hungry. I have done things like that before. The reason behind this is that the Buddha didn't want bhikkhus to be hermits. He didn't want monks to go up and live in caves, grow their own food, or take a sack of rice and lentils and whatever and completely abstract themselves from society. This simple ritual is one which ensures a constant relationship between the monks, the monastic order, and the lay Buddhists. A monk not only is required to receive edibles directly into his hand, but he cannot keep them. If in the case of food, any food must be consumed before 12 o'clock, and any food that's left over must be given up and shared. Usually it's shared with the donors and given back to the lay people who've offered it. There are exceptions for medicines, for instance, tea may be kept indefinitely, salt may be kept indefinitely, and there are certain other medicinal products such as honey, sugar, which may be kept for 7 days. So it's all rather complicated. But certainly, if a monk wants to eat every day, it means he has to go into a village on alms round and receive some food from donors. Now, it's very interesting. If anyone's ever studied Buddhist history, particularly the decline of Buddhism in India, one of the major factors behind that was that the kings often asked the privilege of being the sole donors of the meals for the monks in the monastic universities such as Nalanda. And the monks, being so well looked after, no longer went on alms round. Not going on alms round, that close link between the monks and the lay people weakened. A sense of identification with the monastery, a sense of support, the sense of supporting and contributing to on a daily basis to the life of the sasana disappeared. The interest amongst young men to become monks, the interest amongst parents for their sons to become monks weakened. And I think this is one of the reasons for the decline of Buddhasasana before the Muslim invasions, which were the sort of coup de grace, if you like. The idea has always been that the monks make themselves completely physically dependent, but completely spiritually independent of their lay supporters, and that they should provide moral, spiritual guidance, moral, spiritual leadership in the society. And this is the idea of a Buddhist society. Now the idea, another idea which is very important here, is that there's a distribution or sharing of responsibilities. The monk, for instance, does not involve himself in politics. This is a very important principle. Unfortunately, in those countries which were colonized by the British or the French, the Sangha were called upon to lead the struggle against the colonial powers, and lost that tradition of political neutrality and independence. In Thailand, fortunately, having never become a colony, that principle is still reasonably well maintained. If monks become involved in politics, then they'll become involved with political parties. Although monks might have the same ideas about meditation practice, they might well have different ideas about political matters, and this would create disharmony in the Sangha. Or if the Sangha as a whole became identified with a particular political program and a particular political party, then the other political parties would start to see the Sangha as an enemy, and this would undermine the stability of the Sangha in the society. Similarly, it's highly unlikely that the Sangha would agree with all the principles, all the political programs of a political party that it aligned itself with, and would very likely find itself compromising with certain of its most sacrosanct principles, because it would feel it had no choice. Okay, this party is more or less in line with Buddhist principles more than this party, although it does have this, this, and this that we're not so happy about. But this is the way to decline also. Now, the neutrality of Buddhist monks doesn't mean that they just keep quiet about things going on in society, but their responsibility is to lay down the principles involved, let's say the five precepts, for instance, and allow the lay people to draw their own conclusions as to which political party or which political program is in conformity with those principles and which are not. So the idea in a Buddhist society is that and this is something that you can still see in Thailand and something I've experienced for myself, that the Buddhist monk is a refuge for all people in the society, from the very poorest to the richest, and the whole spectrum of political opinion. So people of right-wing opinions can come and see monks, people of left-wing opinions can come and see monks, and feel a sense of refuge, and that they have some confidence that the monks have no personal axe to grind, but that their duty is to inform the layperson of the Buddhist principles and the Buddhist teachings and the path of liberation that the Buddha taught. Fortunately, in over the past 50 years or so, elite opinions have been alienated from Buddhism, and you find a rather startling and depressing lack of understanding of Buddhist principles amongst the people who run the country. And generally speaking, a number of Western ideas and views have filtered into the popular consciousness without people really realizing. So in theistic societies, you have the idea of the priest as the go-between, or as the representative of the higher power on earth. And he's the one that tells everybody what God wants and what he will reward and what he will punish. And in Buddhist countries, it's noticeable that many people have taken on this way of looking at Buddhist monks. And started to see them as the representatives of the sasana on earth, as it were. And so when there have been scandals involving particular monks, a lot of people said, I've had enough of Buddhism, I'm fed up with it, these monks are not worthy of respect in the way that they used to be. I would say this is a mistaken way of looking at Buddhism, in that the idea is that we have a fourfold assembly of male, female monastics, male, female lay people, all of which have their own particular role to play in creating or maintaining a Buddhist community, a Buddhist society, and that if one of those groups, whether it be the groups of monks or the groups of laity, are not fulfilling their responsibilities, then it's the duty of the other groups to try to help them out and to solve the problem, rather than considering it's their Buddhism. If the monks aren't practicing properly, then Buddhism's in a mess, as if they themselves were not in any way involved. So I don't know how interested you are in this kind of thing, but I myself have given a lot of thought, and I'm very interested in tradition. I'm an Orthodox Theravada monk who's very much conscious of himself as being the inheritor of a tradition, and caring deeply for the tradition that I was ordained into, and wishing to contribute to its transmission to future generations. And so, although I spend a lot of my time alone these days, I still am very concerned with the society in which I live, and in finding the most appropriate ways for me to contribute to the well-being and the further growth and the thriving of Buddha Sasana, the Buddhist religion. So I'm I have done all my training in Thailand and lived in a very traditional monastic environment for since I was 20 years old, more than half my life. And of course this influences the way that I look at practice and my understanding of Buddhism. And speaking with one or two people in the last couple of days, it's really enforced my feeling that there's a real need to emphasize again the importance of some of the core teachings which may not have been taken up in the way that might be most useful. And I'm referring here particularly to that subject I touched on yesterday of faith. Now, if you look in the Buddha's teachings, you will find that faith does not play the central role it does in theistic religions. The religions that grew up in the Middle East, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, I would characterize as belief systems, and they are often called the great faiths. And your membership of one of those religions is defined primarily by your faith, whether or not you believe in the Bible, the Quran, and so forth. This means that people of a theistic background, a Christian background, find Buddhism rather puzzling. And I'm sure those of you who have friends of other religious persuasions find out you're Buddhist, and well, probably the first question that I'll ask you is, what do Buddhists believe in? And there's the automatic assumption that Buddhism is a belief system. It's another kind of belief system. We believe in this. What do you believe in? But Buddhism is not a belief system. Buddhism is an education system. Buddhism consists of an education of every sphere of your life. It's an education, a training of the way you relate to the physical world, training of the way you relate to the social world. It's a training, an education of thought, of emotion, and a training, education, and wisdom. The word faith appears over and over and over again in the Buddha's discourses. But noticeably, it is always, always accompanied by the word wisdom. In any group of dhammas or dhamma teachings that you can find, usually faith will be the first and wisdom will be the last. And there are teachings specifically on the balancing of faith and wisdom. And here we're talking, wisdom is the critical faculty. Dhamma is ehi pasiko, which means come and see, come and challenge, come and question. You know, there's no teaching anywhere at all that be asking difficult, critical questions about the teachings is in any way wrong. Quite the opposite. One's encouraged to take the teachings and put them to the test. The Buddha says, if you attach to things a lot, you know, you'll suffer a lot. If you attach to things less, you'll suffer less. If you don't attach to things at all, you won't suffer at all. So this is a hypothesis the Buddhist is giving us. And it's something that you can take away and look at your life and see, does that make sense? Does that seem to be true to me in my life? And this is how faith really starts to grow strong. Now, the simile used for faith in the tradition, in the commentaries, I believe, is that of the water purifying gem. There's apparently there was a mythical gem which travelers could use walking through wild countryside, very thirsty, come across a muddy pond, a muddy puddle, and you put your magic gem in the puddle, and all the and the muddy particles go down to the bottom, leaving the water above it as crystal clear and able to be drunk to satisfy your thirst. So it's the idea of faith as clarifying. Now, some of you may have heard about this strange brain disease, in which the emotional, those areas of the brain which govern emotion are completely destroyed or don't function. So a person is pure intellect, pure rationality. And it's interesting to see what happens to these people. You would think that, some people might think that that would be quite peaceful or would lead to a comfortable life. But what happens is that people become completely dysfunctional. Just to go to the supermarket and choose between all the different brands, or to choose between all the different kinds of bagels you might eat. You know, there's about 10 or 20 different choices. And there are so many choices in life, and there's so much information, that to follow a purely rational line, you'd never get anything done. And you'd always be doubting the claims and the values of different choices that you have to make. So it's clear here that emotion it plays a big role in choosing a path in your life. And faith is the intelligent emotion when it's founded on this willingness to question and to look clearly at the results of the choices that you make, and to be not just accepting something blindly as a belief, but taking something on as a vehicle to enhance and to provide an engine for spiritual practice. So faith clarifies, faith brightens the mind, faith simplifies. And it's the simplification that's very important. But in terms of practice, perhaps the most important function of faith is that it leads to effort, what we call wiriya. So faith is a spiritual faculty. For those of you who studied any of the teachings, you may have come across this group of dhammas called the indriyas, or the spiritual faculties. The Buddha, first thing in the morning when he awoke, he would go into meditation, and with his clairvoyant eye, he would scan all around the area in which he was living, in order to see if there were any beings whose faculties, whose spiritual faculties, were mature enough to realize enlightenment. If he saw someone who was spiritually mature, meaning their spiritual faculty, their five spiritual faculties were mature, he would often walk many, many miles in order to give that person a Dhamma talk. And sometimes it would be a cowherd, or a tailor's daughter. And on a number of occasions, when his fame had spread far and wide, he would cause quite a sensation by walking into a town, and the equivalent of the mayor and all the merchants would all rush out and make a fuss of him and call everybody together to come and hear a Dhamma discourse from the Buddha. And the Buddha would just sit there quietly, and everybody would start sort of fidgeting and what's going on. And then perhaps, and on one or two occasions, half an hour passes, and a cowherd arrives. He's lost his cow, and he's heard about the talk, but took him a lot longer than he thought. And on one occasion, when this happened, not only did the Buddha wait for this cowherd to come, but he told the leader of the lay community to go and give this man a good meal, because he's too tired and exhausted to be able to benefit from the Dhamma. So everybody, who is this guy? He's just come out of the fields. But the Buddha knew that this man's spiritual faculties were right there and ready, that when he heard the Dhamma, he would realize one of the stages of enlightenment. So I'm telling you this to give you a bit of background, that these spiritual faculties are a very important group of virtues for Buddhist practitioners, and they define the maturity of the heart and mind of one who is on the Buddhist path, and they are a gauge of one's practice and one's development in that path. So faith is an absolutely essential part of the practice leading to Nibbana. It can't be avoided, it can't be overlooked, it shouldn't be denigrated. Certainly it's not the be-all and the end-all. And there is a famous occasion on which some Brahmins went to visit the Buddha, who was flanked by his two great disciples, Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Moggallana. And the Buddha introduced his great disciples. He said, "This is Venerable Sariputta, this is Venerable Moggallana. They are my great disciples, and they're completely faithless." And the Brahmin was totally confused by this, and the Buddha explained that faith is the important virtue for someone who's not yet realized arahantship. But when one's reached the goal, and one has fulfilled and graduated from this education process, then faith is no longer needed. But right up to the level of arahantship, faith becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. It's a defining feature of stream entry, one who's realized the first stage of enlightenment. Faith leads to virya. Virya you often see translated as effort, but the word vira also means hero or heroine. And it means heroic effort. This is spiritually heroic effort. It is the effort to protect the mind from the arising of unwholesome dhammas, to heroically strive to eradicate the unwholesome dhammas that have arisen, heroically strive to bring into existence the wholesome dhammas that have not yet arisen, and heroically strive to nurture and to perfect those wholesome dhammas that have arisen. So here another point you can make is, how do you know if your faith is correct, is authentic, is wholesome, is true? And the gauge of that is that it leads to those four kinds of effort, or four kinds of heroic effort. If your faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha leads you onwards, then it's Buddhist faith. That's that other word that comes up in the Dhamma. The Dhamma leads you onward. It leads you inward, it leads you onward. It doesn't just leave you where you are. If you believe that such and such a thing happened 2,000 years ago, or you believe in some metaphysical process, metaphysical truth, it doesn't necessarily take you anywhere. It's kind of dead-end faith. You know, you either take it or leave it. You believe it or you don't. But Buddhist faith takes you onwards. If it's correctly established faith, it leads you onto those four kinds of effort. Now, how can you know if those four kinds of effort are successful? The answer is that they lead on to mindfulness. Mindfulness is based on those four kinds of effort. Now, how can you know if you're really being mindful, that you're that it's a right mindfulness rather than wrong mindfulness, that you're progressing in mindfulness? But it leads on to the fourth spiritual power of samadhi. Samadhi is the proof of the pudding. Now we say, well, we're going to sit in meditation, we're going to develop samadhi, but actually what we're doing is mindfulness. You don't do samadhi, you don't do vipassana, you do sati, you do mindfulness. You do mindfulness of breathing, you do mindfulness of the unattractive aspects of the body, you do mindfulness of death or whatever. Samadhi is the strength, the stability, the firmness, the one-pointedness of the mind, which has benefited from this continual stream of mindfulness, unbroken stream of mindfulness. My teacher Ajahn Chah used to say, like when you're first meditating, it's like a tap, and the water's drip, 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 and then as you keep practicing, it's drip, 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 and then it becomes a stream of water, and that stream of water is samadhi. So samadhi is the result of the effort that you put in to be mindful. Based on faith in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, you make the effort to be mindful. And the result of that effort to be mindful is concentration, samadhi. Now, how can you know if that's Buddhist samadhi, right samadhi? The samadhi which is what you're aiming at. You know it because it leads to wisdom. So these five faculties are connected. They're not separate. Faith, heroic effort, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom, or panya. Now, I found this a very useful group of dhammas to reflect on in my own practice. And I'll relate to you something happened many, many years ago. I did a long retreat, a solitary retreat, in a cave. And I spent 1 year in a cave, completely black, pitch black cave. And I thought, I'd done my 5 years initial training, and I thought, now I've got what I want. Sensory deprivation, nothing, no responsibilities. It's a pitch black cave. Someone brings me something to eat every morning, twice a month, middle of the night, go down out of the, crawl out of the cave, climb down this rickety bamboo ladder, and go and have a bath in the river, and go and listen to the recitation of the monk's discipline, and that would be the only social contact that I had. Did this for a whole year. And it's not that spiritual practice is not like climbing up a ladder. It just doesn't get better all the time necessarily. And of course there were ups and downs. And at one point I was at a down, you know, and I was just lacking in any kind of energy and any kind of heroic effort. And so I tried to look, you know, what's going on here? What am I lacking? And I thought, well, what's the cause and the condition for the kind of effort that I should be putting forward? And I thought, faith. I realized, like, it's not that you have faith. This is now I've got faith. You know, it's a possession that I have. But faith is a sankhara. It's a condition. It waxes and wanes and completely and can become very weak if it's not cared for and looked after in the right way. So I thought, right now, what can I do to bring up the sense of faith? And what I did was I lit a candle. I had a little shrine And so I bowed to the Buddha. I remembered something that Ajahn Chah once told me when I was newly ordained. I remember it because he complimented me, which is a wonderful thing. He said, "You bow very nicely." That's a wonderful thing for your teacher to say. He said, "You bow very nicely." But he said, "You know," he said, "if you really know how to bow, you'd have tears in your eyes every time. Yeah. If you really knew what a bow meant, and you really knew what Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha meant, and you really knew what paying homage to the Buddha meant, and you really knew what paying homage to the Dhamma meant, you really knew what homage, you'd have tears in your eyes." So, and this came up in my mind. So, I bowed three times to the Buddha, then I bowed three times to Venerable Sariputta, then I bowed three times to Mahamoggallana, then I bowed three times to Venerable Ananda, then I bowed three times to Venerable Anuruddha, then I bowed three times to every great arahant from the Buddha's time that I could think of, and then I started to think of all the great monks of all the traditions that I could think of for the last 2,500 years. And right coming to Ajahn Man and Ajahn Khao and Nipu Wen and all the great teachers in the Thai forest tradition. And after I've been bowing continually for about 30, 40 minutes, it's this great sense of rapture and faith. I just so much energy to sit and walk for, you know, through the rest of the day and night. And I realized that, you know, these teachings, that these are, there's so much in these teachings. It's not just a matter of memorizing them and looking at them every now and again. They're tools to be used. There's so much there. I remember when I first started to practice, I thought, yes, it's like an engineering manual, you know, threes of this, fours of that. You know, I like Zen koans and Zen stories and stuff like that. But when I started to practice it, I found this is much more helpful to me and something that I could really put to use in my daily life. So if your mindfulness is not very good, where's the lack? Step back. Is the effort being put in? These four kinds of right effort. If your samadhi is not very strong, you're having real difficulty, step back. Is the sati, is the mindfulness in daily life, the mindfulness as a stream of mindfulness, is that there or not? Wisdom also needs a firm basis of samadhi. Why? Because we have such a instinctual habit of reacting to experience through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. There is the instinctive, almost immediate grasping at pleasant experience. This is before thought. It happens so quickly. And there is the instinctual habit of pushing away the unpleasant. And it's very, very important to observe that within yourself and to observe that the mind which has been stabilized by samadhi can refrain from that and can stand firm. And when the mind can stand firm in the midst of sensing experience and not react to it in the old conditioned ways, it has the ability to see arising and passing away. So samadhi, if we talk about like IQ and EQ, the modern way of talking, wisdom, investigation, reflection, very important. But we can compare that to the kind of IQ development. Samadhi is EQ development. And sometimes people can, I think, overlook the importance of that. If you're doing so-called vipassana, or you're studying, you feel you're getting something, and there's a sense of gaining there, spending your time usefully. But with samadhi, sometimes it can be discouraging. But these emotional changes that take place over a period of time that give the mind the resilience and the deep internal calm and happiness, which is really essential to penetrate the Dhamma, this comes through the samadhi practice. How many of you have got to that that level of practice where suddenly this incredible irrational fear arises and you just shrink back? You know, you can't, I think, very difficult to deal with those very strong irrational forces that undermine practice without samadhi. Samadhi gives you this deep sense of groundedness and calm and fearlessness. And as I mentioned before, only the truly happy mind can penetrate suffering. This is why samadhi is so important. Often you hear about attachment to happiness and pleasurable states. And sometimes this may be cited as a reason for avoiding samadhi practice or avoiding states of concentration. My answer to that will first be very simply, well, better to be attached to that kind of happiness than any other kind of happiness. But secondly, if you have right view, if you study the teachings, then you'll go through it, basically. Most of the great teachers have spent periods of being attached to blissful states. Inevitably, when you experience the inner rapture, bliss, or peace in the mind, the Buddha said many occasions it's the supreme kind of happiness. The Buddha even went so far as to say the happiness of jhana, of concentration, is like a preview of nibbana. It's a little nibbana, or it's a glimpse of nibbana. If you have right view, if you have your firm in your understanding of the Buddha's teachings, and that no experience, no matter how blissful, will lead to the end of suffering, then after a certain period of time, the mind will graduate from that. But it is part of the path. I don't think that you can go all the way on this path of practice avoiding pleasure. The pleasure of the peaceful mind. So I hope this is good news for you rather than bad news, that sukha and inner bliss is all right. Don't feel guilty about it, or don't shy away from it because you don't think you're worthy of it. It's part of the path, and it's something that you should seek to investigate. I mean, if we consider Dhamma practice as a sense of education, an exploration of the truth of the human condition, then what could be more central to that than fully understanding the nature of pleasure and pain? How can our exploration of our human condition be considered full and complete if it lacks that understanding of different gradations and the subtle variations of sukha, of pleasure and happiness? Certainly, I think it can be seen without too much difficulty that if you have an inner source of happiness, then that kind of wild, manic, distracted kind of search for external pleasures will fall away by itself. And for a lay person, that doesn't mean that one loses all one's zest for life and becomes like a rock or something completely lacking any kind of life, and quite the opposite. But it means that one's search for pleasure in the world will never lead one to harm oneself or others. It will always be within the parameters of the five precepts. And so the happiness that can come from going to watch a movie, listening to music, and all these things, they can become, they're just supplements to the basic internal happiness that one can access all the time. There are certain obstacles to practice which can be seen quite clearly. Others are much more difficult to see. And this is why being in spiritual community is so useful. Having good friends, creating a community of good friends. We all have blind spots. And you say, I don't have a blind spot. I've been looking for years. I've never seen any. But but that's not such a wise attitude. Living together, we rub up against each other. And one of the similes you may have heard is of like rocks that rub up against each other long enough, they become smooth and beautiful, whereas rocks on a mountaintop stay sharp and jagged for hundreds and thousands of years. So living together, we is as good friends, seeking to be good friends to each other, is part of the practice, and it's not a substitute for the real practice. You know, what's the real practice anyway? But you see things in community that you may find very difficult to see in solitude and in meditation. Similarly, as you can see some things in solitude that you find very difficult to see in community. So a balanced practice is one in which you have certain amount of time to dwell in solitude and to develop a taste, develop a zest, a love of solitude. But at the same time, one develops an appreciation for the discomfort that arises from being with other people. We have many monastic practices which are aimed at promoting peace and harmony in the group. But we also have practices which are meant to stir people up. Now, one of them is that monks, we eat one meal a day out of one vessel. We have in Thailand, we have our daily meal at around 8:30. Daily schedule, the bell would go at 3 o'clock, and in most monasteries there would be a morning chanting period at 3:30, followed by a group meditation at 4 to 5. At 5, the monks would go to the hall and set up their places, and about 5:30, walk off into the surrounding villages on alms round. Get back about 7, a bit of free time to meditate or whatever, and then the meal is offered at 8, eaten at 8:30. Now, if you only eat one meal a day, and you've been up, monks don't sleep very much, and sometimes there's quite a lot of there's work to do, physical work to do. If you've just walked 3 or 4 miles on a completely empty stomach, in a very hot, humid climate, carrying a big bowl of sticky rice, which can weigh quite a lot, you're hungry, and there's a lot of desire for food comes up. And when you have, there's a huge difference between eating one meal a day and eating twice a day. Many monks eat twice a day, and that's completely legitimate, as long as you finish before 12 o'clock. So, if you really wanted to promote peace, a peaceful mind, amongst the young monks, you'd just say, well, we'll eat twice. You know, we'll have a bit of a breakfast before alms round and just sort of take the edge off our hunger, and then have a second meal at 11 o'clock. I think. But in the forest monasteries, we don't do that. You eat once, and you know, whatever you've got in your bowl is going to last you for 24 hours. And you would be surprised, I think, just how much defilement comes up when you know this is all you're going to get for 24 hours. If you've never done it, you probably quite, strong emotions. And when I was first a monk, yeah, this is one of those good old days stories there, at Wapapong, all the food was offered, and then the monks would all get up and dish the food out. And you just walk down the line with a big ladle and just go like this into each all the bowls, and you got the bowl of sticky rice, and then you got these horrible kind of curries all going, and you just don't know what they are. You know, they have curries with red ants in them, and I remember saying, "There's a red ant in my bowl." He said, "That's part of the curry." And sort of frogs floating on their back like that, and all kinds of I won't go into all these horror stories about Northeast Thailand food, but not only once you've got all that thrown in your bowl, then all the sweet things get thrown in there, and all the fruit gets thrown in there, everything, and so you come back to your bowl, and then because you're so hungry as well, everything's done, but it's very strict etiquette, and Ajahn Chah will be sitting there at the top of the hall. And the idea is that you sit there, and he talks with the donors and just has a bit of a chat, gives them a few teachings, and you sit and you're supposed to be meditating, but everybody's sort of looking, when's he going to stop talking? and Ajahn Chah had this habit where before he started to chant, he'd always clear his throat like this. So you'd be sitting there, listen, you hear the sound, and you're ready to chant. And then quite often he'd continue talking again. And he was doing it. This was not undeliberate. there is a particular word that's used in Thai forest tradition called Toraman, which if you look up in the book, the translation you'll find in the dictionary is torture, but actually it has a technical meaning, which means to train by means of going against defilement. So it feels like torture, but I mean the rationale is that the only way that you can clearly see the stream of craving is to go against that stream sometimes. So this is going against the flow rather than going with the flow. And although Ajahn Chah couldn't speak English at all, I mean, he was a master at allowing you to see the Four Noble Truths in your daily life. Okay, you can study the Four Noble Truths, but when you're just full of this kind of irritation and resentment and so on, then you think, what's going on here? Why is this? And you see, I'm suffering because of what? I'm suffering because of craving. And the only way that I can free myself from my suffering is to let go of this craving. So you're getting that kind of teaching, and the one meal a day practice is not spiritual practice meant to promote peace and harmony in the sangha. It's one part of a monk's day in which the daily program is intended to bring up negative emotions in order to be able to see them and let go of them. So it's not the spiritual life, it's all meant to be pleasant and all meant to promote peace. But we want to be really looking at the way our minds work, the way that we create dukkha moment by moment. And there is a certain place for this. Now, if you live with people, it's not so peaceful, usually, as living by yourself. Because you can do things the way you want to do them, you have your own schedule, and you don't have to put up with other people's personalities, and you don't have to get that awkward feeling when you realize that people have a different idea about who you are than you have. But then, you know, that's exactly what it's about. Like being good friends and seeing particularly the things that find very difficult to see when you're meditating by yourself are attachment to view. Okay, you can see a thought arising, passing away, you have a feeling, happy feeling, unpleasant feeling. You can see mental states, and you can see mental objects and so on, the satipatthana, but to see a deeply held view or attitude, that's difficult in meditation, isn't it? To see conceit. And views and conceit are very important defilements and obstacles to practice. What's conceit? Buddha said there's conceit is this, he says it's raising the flag of self. This is who I am. And it can be I'm better than you, or I'm equal to you. Who do you think you are? You're no better than me. That's conceit. And it also means most expressions of humility. If that's coming from a sense you're so much better than I am, you're so much more pure, you're so much wiser than I am, that's conceit. That's a defilement. Now, of course, there is an authentic and reasonable assessment of abilities. I think that I can speak Thai better than most of you, because I've been living in that country for 26 years. But I don't say that because of that I'm a better person. See? And this way that we create a person, we create a personality out of non-personal elements, is something that's really at the heart of the dukkha production machine. And we can see that certainly in community more easily than we can see it in meditation practice, I would argue. It's its highest level, and the level where we're cutting through that defilement, yes, it's on the level of meditation, but it must be supported by, complemented by the practice, spiritual practice in community. I think very important. This conceit of being somebody, defining yourself in terms of certain qualities, it's always about the five khandhas in the end. You're attaching to certain, you're attaching to your body. So, you know, how many people seek for refuge in the sense of, you know, a strong, healthy body, people going to gyms to build up their body. We can say, you know, I'm somebody, I'm somebody who's people look at, or I'm somebody who's strong and healthy, or I'm beautiful, or I'm handsome. And we have this word I that we attach to all these different things. We attach the word I to the physical body, we attach the word I'm happy, I'm unhappy, we attach the word to feelings, we attach it to perceptions, we attach it to thoughts, to emotions. Because we have this single word I, we tend to feel that it must refer to one single thing. And that's a mistake. And one of the great teachings, I remember years and years ago, I read some teacher saying, it is raining. What is raining? What does the word it refer to in the sentence, it is raining? It's the same to say, I'm handsome, and, you know, I'm skinny, I'm too fat, I'm happy, I'm unhappy, I think this, I believe that. You know, this idea that there is this this single independent entity, I, that has all these attributes. Now, one of the problems with this is that the moment you identify with a certain quality, you tend to lose your ability to see everything which is not that. So, for instance, if you get into this, I should be, I shouldn't be, what can happen is you think, as a Buddhist, I should be calm, or I should be kind. And if you're not careful, after this, I should be, I should be, I should be, and after a while it becomes, I am kind. I am kind because I'm a Buddhist. And if you really believe that you are kind, and I'm sure most of you are, generally speaking, kind people, but severely hamper your ability to see the arising and passing away of unkind impulses in your mind. If you think I'm an honest person, then you're going to find very difficult to see those dishonest impulses that arise in almost everybody's mind, except for enlightened beings. So this is one of the ways in which this conceit hampers. One particular kind of conceit which the Buddha talked about, or one expression of it, refers to that we have this idiom in Thai which means lifting yourself up and pushing others down. And it's considered those two things go together. The Buddha gave a Dhamma talk once, it's very interesting. He says, if you keep all the precepts purely, and on the basis of the purity of your sila, you in any way denigrate someone who doesn't keep precepts purely, you're a fool. The purity of your sila is thereby destroyed by that sense of superiority that you identify with, over those who don't keep sila. If you're a good, so-called good meditator, and you can meditate for hours in a single position, you can sit on a wooden bench for hours and not move, you think, all those sissies sitting on cushions, to think that you're somehow better than somebody who doesn't have that quality, your practice is defiled by that. Your practice is undermined by it, and the Buddha says you're not a sapurusa, you're not a what's called the good man or the good woman or the sage, and that goes through every single level of spiritual practice. It's just that moment of thinking you're better than someone because of that attainment, because of that realization. That realization, that attainment, is immediately sullied. And that's a wonderful teaching that the Buddha gave us, and very important one to remember. But the practice, the Buddha said, practice of liberation. He said, 84,000 Dhamma doors, 84,000 Dhamma khandhas. The Buddha said, every single one of those is concerned with liberation. He said, just as the water of the oceans, of all the oceans of the world, has a single taste, the taste of salt. Similarly, every single teaching that I've given you has this taste of liberation. So how does that apply? Okay, what's the practice of dana? What's it about, really? What's its role in spiritual life? Or is this just sort of nursery school, kindergarten stuff that, now you're on the path of intensive meditation, you have to worry about? The Buddha said that dana is incredibly important in that it is a very effective tool to promote liberation from attachment to the material world. Especially as lay people, attachment to your wealth, the money that you've earned with so much difficulty, the material wealth, lovely house, beautiful pictures, wonderful car, wonderful this, wonderful that. There's always going to be a certain amount of attachment to things that give you pleasure, legitimate pleasure, in your life. And dana is a way of preventing that attachment from becoming an obstacle in spiritual life. There's a sense of liberation when you can give something freely and find that joy in giving. Again, this is part of the emotional aspect of spiritual life. Not just studying the three characteristics, but finding that joy in giving. And although Thai Buddhist society is deficient in so many ways, I believe, in terms of giving, it's just so inspiring to see the level of giving and the joy that people. You see Thai people go to monasteries. They don't get all kind of tense, and they have a good laugh. They really enjoy going to monasteries and making food and offering it to the monks. And that's a skill. That's a wise aspect of Thai Buddhist culture. You've got to enjoy this. And what could be more enjoyable than sharing freely something you have with beings that you revere and look up to and are maintaining and supporting the tradition that you belong to. And giving anything. As monks, we don't have material things to give to anyone. When we leave our teacher to go wandering or to go somewhere, we have a tradition of getting this particular kind of wood, and you cut it into lengths like this, and you hammer the top, and the top comes over like this, looks a bit like a mushroom, and then you chop it up like this, and you make toothwoods out of it. It takes a long time to make these individual toothwoods, and about 20 toothwoods you make into a set. You wrap them up nicely, and then when you go to say goodbye to your teacher, you ask forgiveness for anything that you might have done, and this is your gift to your teacher, these toothwoods that you've made. And it just feels so good that you've spent all these hours. I'm hopeless with a knife and with these kinds of things. It's just so difficult for me to make these, and I'm quite self-conscious. They're not really quite straight and beautiful like those of some of my friends, but yeah, I mean, I really made these things with so much effort. It's something to offer to my teacher, and that means of sharing and giving. Beautiful. So it's liberation from stinginess. It's liberation from attachment to material things, and it's something which promotes a really warm feeling of friendship in a community, isn't it? Indeed, in teachings on the eradication of anger, resentment, one of the teachings is if you've gone through all the meditation techniques and all the wise reflections and you're still angry with that person, find something really nice and give them a present. You'd be surprised how difficult it is to hate someone that you have given a present to. Try it. There's something really magical about giving. So there is a liberation. Keeping the precepts, you're liberated from the bad karma that will lead to rebirth in lower and awful realms of being. If you practice mindfulness and you can maintain your practice, you will experience liberation from the five hindrances. If you practice the wisdom, then you can, that comes from the peaceful mind, you can realize the highest kind of liberation. So this teaching of liberation is not something way up there. It means, are you living in a liberated way? Are you liberating yourself moment by moment through your practice? Are those five spiritual faculties there being looked after, cared for, and developed? So I know most of you are on the path of meditation, but I've specifically, yesterday and today, I'm trying to open this out and really seeing, you know, the context in which the meditation practice is to be developed rather than getting into technical details on meditation techniques, because I think you probably have a lot of that kind of information already, and I feel it's very easy to get in the idea that this is kind of magic bullet, or this is some kind of special. Ajahn Jayasaro's come from Northeast Thailand, perhaps he'd have this really special technique that we've never heard before, and if we hear this then we try it, maybe, you know, this will be the thing. Now, I don't think it works like that, basically. But you need to have developed this barami, this moral, emotional, intellectual, spiritual maturity. It's not that you don't know what to do, but it's just that the mind and the heart and the accumulated barami is not yet to the level where it's going to bear fruit. And you bring your mind to that level through this education of every part of your life. You know, it means what you're doing, how you live your life, how you treat your spouse, how you treat your kids, what you do when you're driving your car, what your attitude to the other drivers is, you know, how you relate to people at work. It's everything. So finding this kind of right attitude is really important. The more you see the more you study the teachings of the Buddha, the more this faith arises. Yes, the Buddha was the perfectly self-enlightened one. He was truly enlightened, and the Dhamma, the teachings of it, was the most perfect, most superb, brilliant articulation in language of something which was beyond language. And the Sangha of his enlightened disciples are those who prove that this wasn't just a one-off. It wasn't just this absolutely unique human being who attained something that nobody else could attain. But the enlightened beings from the time of the Buddha, both the monastics and the lay practitioners throughout Buddhist history, have proved that this is something that it works. It does work. There are people who are practicing and receiving the fruits of the practice all over the world right now. Now, if you really have confidence in that, and you have confidence that if they can do it, so can I. If you can develop that kind of faith, then I think you're well set. So, in the words of the ancient sages, go for it. I think probably that's enough for the discourse, and now I open up questions about.